And actually, by my true nature, I'm not a patient person. I get very frustrated. But I know that just showing frustration doesn't get results. And we did have really quite a remarkable devotion to objectives back in getting this charter put together. And that atmosphere, you spoke earlier of the atmosphere of having come through the war and just in the stage of ending the war, but the war actually still being going on when we first met, and the VE Day only coming during the conference, and then the other war not ending until after it. It was a world atmosphere that was quite significant.
Do you remember VE Day? Did anything happen on that day, or did the conference just go on working and no particular celebrations?
There was nothing that you could call a celebration there, and of course was a very important news. A lot of informal discussions. I can't remember any certain event connected with it, of what you'd call a celebration. Eagerness for news. It did, I think, just about that time, some additional delegates arrived. It seems to me that in the case of Denmark, some additional people arrived after VE Day, in effect, were able to come then. And then I think that might have happened in some other countries.
Did you get the feeling that there was a sort of esprit de corps among all the delegations?
Yes, especially, when it reached the stage. Well, that day when it was realized that here was a document that no one had any other motions to make upon it of amendment or question, and they all voted for it. The session broke out into applause. That's the first time that had happened in all those weeks of struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was some of that sort of from that time on, that special esprit de corps that they had all been a part of something.
Mm-hmm.
And had different views of what it might finally mean, but at least that it was something and something significant.
Sometimes in conferences I've found that the delegates often get such a warm feeling towards each other that they sort of have more empathy for their colleagues than they almost do for their own foreign offices or state departments, that they get very close in their relationships. Did you find that at all?
I wouldn't say that. No, not, I didn't really...
Mm-hmm.
Find that kind of a feeling. But there certainly was developed a degree of rapport as human beings with each other
mm-hmm.
through those many weeks. And of course, you see, part of the, you might say, the follow-through in my case, too, was disrupted in the sense that I went right back out then to rejoin the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Within a few days after the signing, I flew back out to rejoin the Navy for the rest of the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, Governor Stassen, I do thank you very much for so generously giving of your time. I hope that we're going to have the chance in another session to talk about other matters such as Security Council.
Well,
and
if you can.
Evaluation.
Yes, if. Is it available this afternoon?
It certainly is.
I must go to a luncheon meeting I have here in New York. But I'll come back, if it's all right,
That's
at 2:30.
Yes.
And then I am willing to discuss what my feelings are about potential future
evaluation and potential future.
For future,
that will be wonderful. Thank you very much.
See you.
Governor Stassen, in our previous session, we spoke mostly about your input to the trusteeship section of the Charter. We touched also on how you saw your role. In this session, to begin with, I'd like to ask you, with your extremely active role as negotiator and mediator in the trusteeship section, which the debate particularly, which seems to have run from early May to June 20, how did you juggle your other assignments?
Well, of course, those were long days, but also I had a very able staff that developed to work with me. I mentioned earlier that Ralph Bunch and Ben Gehrig worked with me a great deal, and then Cord Meyer and John Thompson. And then at times when there were other assignments, there would be other members of the Foreign Service staff that would assist. So that's the way it worked. But there were long hours. There's no doubt that most of the members of the delegation, if not all, would work from frequently and starting with an 8 o'clock breakfast on up to sessions that would go 10, 11 at night of different consultations and so forth.
Could you elaborate a little more, particularly at this moment, on the work of these advisors, exactly what sort of work they did, how they helped you?
Well, it would be a variation depending on the circumstances. Sometimes they would go to consult somebody that you wanted them to go out to consult and report back. Sometimes they would do a draft of an idea or of an amendment. And other times they would put together the different proposals of different delegations. So there was a variation in staff work.
Mm-hmm. But did somebody sit in for you on the various committees to keep you up, or did you just get your information on what had happened from the delegation meetings?
Well, on the important committees, one of the staff people would sit in and listen and report back in addition to the official minutes that you'd get, but in order to have an immediate input as to what was happening.
Well, one of the subjects we'd like to ask you about in this session is, of course, concerning international peace and security, particularly your role in Commission 3 with Senators Vandenberg and Connolly, I believe. Could you clarify the committee responsibilities of each of you? Were they clearly divided, or what did you work as a team?
Well, it was clear in each instance who would be the, you might say, most responsible U.S. delegate in one particular subject or one particular committee, and then who would have the sort of supporting or second or deputy role. And on international peace and security, it was, of course, clear from the beginning that this was the most sensitive in relationship to the ratification of the Charter subsequently by the United States Senate, and therefore that Senator Connolly and Senator Vandenberg had the key roles there, and the rest of us were supporting, implementing, working along with them in that respect.
You mentioned advisors earlier. Which ones worked on you, worked with you on the Security Council?
I think particularly Ralph Bunch did, and Cord Meyer.
Oh, I see. I thought they were specialized in trusteeship matters.
No, no.
Oh, I see.
No, not just trusteeship. They did specialize, but they also handled other things.
Well, as with the Trusteeship Council and our discussions this morning, what we're especially interested in is what, of course, is not on record, interaction of the various personalities at the Big Four and Five meetings, any consultations to which you were party, subcommittee meetings, and informal negotiations with the smaller powers, and views within the U.S. delegation, as well, of course, as your own personal viewpoint. We touched this morning on the right of regional groups to defend themselves without prior authorization of the Security Council. I wonder if you would like to elaborate a little more on your own involvement on this.
Well, I initiated the first memorandum as to having an article in the Charter about the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs, and persisted in that as being very vital in order to have a document that wouldn't be misinterpreted in the future in reference to such a circumstance. And, of course, in the collective self-defense aspect, that did involve the question of regional concerns. And there were some very acute regional concerns as to whether the world organization would preempt a regional situation of working out a solution. And there were very active views and conferences, adjustments on these subjects. And of course, in the very basic thing, there was considerable discussion of the need of some kind of a weighted vote. On the other hand, it was soon found to be completely impossible to work out any kind of a weighted vote at that time and to attain a charter, so that we were left with the circumstances of having an assembly with one state, one vote, except for the adjustment in the case of the Soviet Union and their special plea about, in effect, having three votes in the assembly, which had been that special concession that had been made to them. And then the other side, the absolute veto in the Security Council. And so then they became adjustments as to just how comprehensive that veto could be and how the assembly could act without the Security Council stopping them, but not having the same effect as Security Council action. And there was recognition that a lot of this would have to be work out over the future and actual experience. And of course, this ties right in with my view and our view then, that in 10 or 15 years there ought to be a weighted voting development. I think this is one of the very urgent matters for what you might call the next 35 years of the United Nations. And in my own reflection of what we went through at the time of the original drafting of the Charter and the different thoughts expressed then and the current situation, I have thought that perhaps the best weighted voting system to develop would be to have a new body in the total United Nations picture, and that this could be in effect between the Security Council and the Assembly. Could be a sort of a council of ministers selected on a regional basis through weighted voting and acting with the members of it having a weighted vote. And so that, in effect, this Council of Ministers would be somewhat like a cabinet to the Secretary General. I think to have a more formal and clear relationship for the Secretary General as a continuing thing, and to have a weighted voting reflection of a way in which to take action, if you think it through, is quite important for the long-term future. And I have thought that perhaps the best method would be to take and rank all the members by population and by gross production, gross national product. Put these two rankings together and thereby attain one ranking, and then take a certain number at the smallest amount of population and the smallest amount of production combined, gross national production, give them a certain amount of weighted vote, and then step up a certain number of additional ones would have certain additional weighted vote. So you might say that you'd have in the 157 or more states, a certain number might have a weighted vote of 10, another number would have a weighted vote of 20, another number would have a weighted vote of 30, and perhaps on up to somewhat like 100 votes for the largest and highest production powers. And these votes would be cast in regions to select regional representatives on a council of ministers. And the council of ministers might be from like 11 to 15. And I think working out over a period of future years that to reflect what was very much needed now and which it was not possible to work out in any manner in the original charter, although there had been quite a few weighted voting proposals brought forward by the original member states in various ways. I've also felt, of course, as we originally structured it, the working out of the methods of arbitration and mediation and conciliation and judicial decisions of disputes. We could only make very limited provisions in that respect in the original charter under all the exigencies of that time. But I think now, with the experience and with the modern situation, in any revision of the charter or new charter, there needs to be a great expansion. And I think in terms, if you had a regular group of individuals who were skilled mediators and conciliators, arbitrators, so that they could be assigned to particular disputes, and in many instances, as we know, they would have to work on a particular dispute over a period of years before they worked a solution. But getting that kind of peacemaking solution group structured and developed, I think, is very important. Another area which, as you know, in the present charter, the language hasn't really been implemented or possible to implement, is the matter of any, except in a sort of an oblique way, any armed forces or police forces under the United Nations itself. I believe that in the long-term future, a highly skilled volunteer force or individuals, multilingual, who would volunteer to be on a peacekeeping or police force, not a war-fighting force, but a force to step into sensitive situations and just be stabilizing, and who would definitely not be under the command or withdrawal power of any one member, but had a distinct United Nations status, would be a very constructive move for the next 35 or 50 years. And I believe there, you could also, of course, provide that not more than a certain percentage of such a volunteer force could be of any one nationality. But I think the progress that's been made under the United Nations now and such, and the recognition of it, that there'd be an adequate number of very competent young people who would volunteer for such a force and who would be within the United Nations jurisdiction for their work. And I think in these sensitive, troublesome spots, these could be of great help in the future in stability and in keeping peace. Then, of course, there are all these new fields of outer space and the Antarctica, the matter of the depths of the ocean, the matter of the objectives of ending world hunger and working on the environment, a greater priority emphasis. In other words, if the charter were now redrawn in an effort to look ahead to the next 35 years and try to project these factors, obviously, outer space has the potential of being very important for peacekeeping for under a United Nations approach. It also has dangers in it in relation to war possibilities, and which way space would develop should be a great concern of and the subject of priority attention in the restructuring of the United Nations of the future. These are some of my thoughts applied now to some of the discussions back there that long ago as we were getting the first charter put together.
Well, In the early days, when you had your own ideas on how an organization should be conceptualized, I think you more or less, if I recall correctly, drew them up into about 9 priority areas. Mm-hmm. Could you, having done this very interesting elaboration, just put them into sort of areas of priority just by listing? I think it would be interesting to have them in how you see the major objectives of the charter and the organization as they should be perhaps looked at today.
Of course, I think the basic objective still should continue to be to prevent a third world war. In other words, and that's become even more important with the development of the nuclear age. And I think the specifics and the priorities and the definite proposals will come forward from many countries and many individuals if the process once gets started, and it'll take quite a while to carry it out. But and I wouldn't attempt to be too comprehensive or at all arbitrary in it in this interview right now, other than to hope that the project would get up on the front page of the drawing board, so to speak, try to look ahead another 35 or 40 years. What kind of an organization do you need to adequately handle it? And I think many people will bring forward then thoughts, and they have to be evaluated and discussed and negotiated in the process. But I would emphasize very, very much that the institution that we then originated in that charter, we never expected to be able to stay in its present form or its same form for this long a time, and certainly not for the indefinite future. So that from our concepts and our work in the original drawing of the charter, it is high time to get working on, in a very priority way, high priority way, the gradual process of redrafting and restructuring for the future.
Well, given the present state of affairs in the world and the way the UN has sort of programmed its way of work these days, how do you think this can come about?
Well, of course, it has to be some of the governments starting to take initiatives and some of the United Nations personnel starting to bring forward initiatives. And the tremendous pressure of events and the circumstance is such to really to more kind of drift along with the present structure. That's the great problem. Mm. It's not easy to lift out. And I think at one stage back there, when there was a certain amount of the, gloomy discussion that, how could we get the job done? I spoke of the history of how the United States got going and first had the 13 colonies and how they almost broke apart and failed. And then suddenly out of the problems and weaknesses came the new structure. And I use that as not an exact example, of course, for the great diversity in forms of government and in economic and social and political systems, but more to say that we should not take too much counsel of doubts, but get an affirmative approach to what is needed. And certainly the necessity of preventing a third world war is even more acute and important now than it was when we originally drafted the first charter. And at the same time, the tremendous scientific advances in communication around the world and the development of outer space make things possible now that couldn't have been contemplated at that time in the way of communication and production and distribution and the quality of life for the people.
Well, you know very well that such ideas have to start with governments. They've got to be brought forward in some way. Have you discussed these ideas within the U.S. government, with the State Department, for instance?
At times they have been, and really have to, this kind of initiative either has to start within governments or among people that then cause the governments to start to move.
Exactly.
You never can draw an exact line as to how things get moving, but and of course in the original United Nations there were individuals and governments in various parts of the world that gave special push, special leadership, and you can't chart exactly how it'll happen, but I just express the hope that it will happen.
Well, I think they are wonderful hopes, and we certainly hope they will, and you put forward a lot of extremely interesting ideas as to how one might get down to the Charter today. Would you be prepared to sit down and with 157 nations today and try to rethink the whole Charter? Do you think this would be possible?
Absolutely. And obviously you'd divide into subcommittees and things of that kind and working groups, but and different levels of attention. But everyone should be involved in it.
Have you thought how you might attack this from the grassroots up, as it were? In so many of the work, in so much of the work of the agencies, for instance, attention is being put on working from the grassroots up in the World Health Organization, primary health care, starting from the bottom, working up to the top, with the International Labour Organization, with many of the other organizations. Do you have any ideas as to how one might nurture setting forth these ideas through non-governmental organizations or through the media?
I think it has to start in a multiple of ways, and that you cannot predict which ones will move the most, anything as basic as this. And also, of course, that one of the fundamentals has to be that rather than criticism of the United Nations in a negative way, there has to be the affirmative turn as to how it can be improved and made more adequate for, as I say, a whole future generation. There is a tendency, and this is just human, it's universal almost, that if something isn't quite working the way an individual or a group wants it to just emphasize that it's not working right without taking that other step and say it ought to be functioning in XYZ manner, or it ought to have its structure amended in a certain way. So that just that positive turn, which I hope will come up from many places, what is necessary to have the United Nations be adequate for its purposes for the next 35 years? Just that basic kind of change in analysis. You can say, you can put the whole emphasis, what is it that is now inadequate in the experience under the original charter? Like, they will say, well, how would you have redrawn the charter if you could foresee what was happening now? Well, I emphasize, really, that we drew the best charter we could at that time. We knew of some of its limitations, but it was a matter of, do you get a organization going or not at all? And we decided that in the form that we were able to put together, it was desirable to get it started. And I think, as I said earlier, the fact that we are here 35 years later and more, and there has not been a Third World War, is to considerable measure to the credit of the fact that there has been such an organization of the United Nations. Now then, instead of the very heavy emphasis so often on negatives, I'd like to see the end. We'll be advocating continuously a changing to the positive. What kind of a United Nations should we have for the next 35 years in order to accomplish the objectives?
Well, again, I would go back to asking you if you think that this approach could come through the United States in the General Assembly, for instance, or do you see it as
something
that...
It might in time. You never know just how those situations develop.
But I mean, apart from speaking about it today, have you made any efforts to reach out to individuals in other countries?
Yes.
Through any sort of organized program, network?
Well, it's, you might say, through whatever avenues are open. And, of course, the stimulating the academic circles, stimulating governments, and responding to inquiries and so forth.
When you
and
see
encouraging the media to do deeper analysis and things of that kind.
When you say responding to queries, inquiries, from whom?
From individuals and governments.
They just write to you, you mean?
Yes. See, I've also been active in, for instance, the World Peace Through Law movement of the World Judges Association and the World Lawyers Association, and when they had the world meeting a few years ago in Geneva, and I was chairman of World Law Day,
uh-huh.
There was a lot of discussion at that time. Now, for example, in that respect, see, one of the my feelings it was for years that the best contribution to peace was to